And now, it's time for the Talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning to you. It's 5 minutes past nine on this Friday, the 5th of April, 2024, and you're very welcome along to a very busy 9 till noon show. Our Friday panel has assembled. I'll introduce them to you in a moment. Seamus Gunn will be joining us after 10. With answering all of your legal questions, and that's entertainment comes up between 11 and 12 as well. We want you involved in the conversation throughout the course of the show, of course, and the lines are open for you right now. 086 60 25000, your WhatsApps and texts to that number. You could send WhatsApp voice notes to that number as well on WhatsApp. You can give us a call on 074 91 25000 or email comments at highlandradio.com. And if you want to watch the show, and pretty much all of our guests today on your big screen, your smart TV. Open up your smart TV, open the YouTube app, Highland Radio Ireland, the same on your Fire Stick. And we're across Facebook as well, Highland Hub, Highland News and Sport, and on the X platform. Good morning to you all. Right, okay. Let us say good morning to our guests now. Dr. Peter O'Rourke, retired consultant, orthopaedic surgeon. Peter, great to have you back on the show. Good morning to you.
Morning, Greg.
Also, we have with us Emma Gover, the wee Donegal mammy. Good morning to you, Emma. Thanks for your time today.
Morning, Greg.
And we have also Deputy Thomas Pringle, an independent deputy. Hi, Thomas.
Morning, Greg. How's it going?
Good. Now, we have a number of things to discuss, but I think when you talk about things like this, and it doesn't matter whether it's a local radio station or national, what have you, it's very hard to ignore, nor would we want to ignore what's happening in the Middle East. And Israel has announced that it would allow temporary aid deliveries into famine-threatened northern Gaza hours after the United States warned of a sharp shift in its policy over the Gaza war. In a tense, as we're told, 30-minute phone call yesterday, President Joe Biden told Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that U.S. policy on Israel was dependent on the protection of civilians and aid workers in Gaza, the first hint of possible conditions to Washington's military support. Now, the development seems to have been triggered following the deaths of six aid workers, and not necessarily perhaps the at least 33,000 Palestinians that have been killed. Arguably, it says an awful lot about humanity as well as anything else. Deputy Thomas Pringle, I suppose, would you say this is a welcome intervention from the US, or too little, too late, or it opens up a whole ton of questions really about how we operate in this planet?
Yeah, it does really, Greg, and that's what the most that this says. But I think it is positive that the Americans are finally getting the finger out and actually putting pressure on the Israelis. And I think that's down to the world opinion and the pressure that people are putting on them. And also, it has more to do with the American election and the US election than it has to do with anything to do with the Palestinians, unfortunately. And Biden seems to be coming under pressure from his own Democratic supporters in relation to what's happening in Palestine. And that's where this is coming from. I'm saying that it is welcome, but it's by the sounds of things, it only is going to be a temporary respite. So basically, the Israelis are going to allow the Palestinians to have some deep before they continue killing them. And that seems to be what the message is that's coming out from us. But I think what we need to do as a world is maybe try and put pressure on the Americans, because they seem to be more open to it than on the Israelis. And if we can cut off the supply of weapons to Israel, they won't be able to continue on with the slaughter.
Emma, what's your views?
I welcome it, but for me, I don't want to say it's too little too late, because any progress is good progress, but I think it's a shocking indictment of society that seven aid workers had to be killed after the thousands of Palestinians that have been killed and are still being killed and are being starved to death. And they have been moved from one part of Gaza to the other. I mean, these people were told they were being moved to safety. A lot of them moved to Rafah because they were told that that's where they were to go. And then he talked about making a ground invasion of Rafah. I mean, this is just herding Palestinians into one area to make them easier to pick off, as far as I can see. And, you know, from October, nobody is stating that what happened by Hamas in October was anything other than disgraceful and diabolical. But this collective punishment for the people of Palestine is wrong, and it's genocide and it's a war crime. And it should be called out for that. And we should be doing an awful lot more to support the people of Palestine to get a long-term ceasefire and to implement the two states.
Do we not kind of also have to challenge ourselves, really, and face the reality that there is a different value put on life dependent on the color of your skin.
It's complexion protection. That's what it is. At the end of the day, 33,000 Palestinians have died, but and I'm not absolutely not taken away from the 7 aid workers that were killed, but the outrage, and it's simply because, I'm sorry, but it is, when we see that across the world, and I'm not in any way taken away from what's happened to the people of Ukraine at all. I have great support for the people of Ukraine, but it took us a lot longer to acknowledge what was going on in Syria as well. I mean, we had reporters on the TV saying at the start of the Ukraine war, you know, their children look like us and they go to school, you know, they go to school like us, as if to, you know, so did Palestinian children, so did Syrian children, and so did Sudanese children. At the end of the day, we need to take a long, hard look at ourselves and realise that this is a human issue. And you know, there's one race, in my opinion, it's the human race. And I feel like we have let the people of Palestine. I know there have been lots of people raising the issue out there. I know Deputy Pringle has done it repeatedly. I know other people from People Before Profit have done it as well, and Social Democrats and things like that. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's a shocking indictment that 33,000 people in Palestine have died. And it only has really, America has only really started putting pressure on Israel now after 7 aid workers have died. And it is, I'm sorry, that might be a non-PC way to put it, but it is complexion protection, 110%.
Okay, your former health colleagues, Peter O'Rourke, they are hosting a vigil this evening, as they do every, or this afternoon, as they do every Friday, it seems now, between 1 and 2pm at the main entrance of Letterkenny University Hospital. They say everyone is welcome there. But Peter, just your reflections on what we've been discussing so far.
Well, no, I don't think anything I've heard in the news recently will make any difference. Effectively, it's a bit like Neville Chamberlain waving his piece of paper in 1936 saying peace in our time. Nothing's going to change. People in Ireland realise that this is not any criticism you have. It's not a criticism of Judaism. It's Israel, which is a Zionist state, which was founded in 1948 by terrorist activities. The Stern Group petrobombed, they car bombed and shot British troops, and they basically cleared out Arab settlements. So the fact that they're suffering the consequence of terrorism is appalling, and what happened in October was appalling. But I don't think the Israeli state will rest until they have removed every Palestinian from the state of Israel, from Gaza and the West Bank. And unfortunately, the world cannot criticise them because of the Holocaust and the propaganda that goes around. If you criticise Israel, you're anti-Semitic, and what about the Holocaust?
Is that not changing a little bit now? Because I just do kind of note a change whereby you are actually getting news presenters to sort of ask these challenging questions, and often the response is really quite angry, and how could you even imagine such a thing? But the presenters persist with their questions. I just wonder, is this sort of that protection that you talk of fading now, whereby, you know, Israel is facing tougher scrutiny, the same scrutiny it should have faced months and months ago. But I just wonder, is the tide turning a little bit in that regard, that they might actually start seeing that the international reputation is heading towards, if not already, destroyed?
I don't think it's changing rapidly enough. I mean, it's like Irish Americans thinking that everything in Britain was done to destroy Ireland. And these are people who left the country, you know, hundreds of years ago, or certainly generations ago. In America, the Jewish community is a very strong lobby for Israel, and they're Jewish and their support for Israel is unflinching. And that's part of the problem Joe Biden has, because there's such a strong Jewish lobby in America. There's a strong Irish lobby in America, and we've benefited from it in part. But it also ties his hands when he's trying to do things. And it plays a big role in America. And unfortunately, I think it has given the state of Israel carte blanche to do what it wants to. Mm-hmm.
Simon Harris has been meeting with independents to shore up support for his government after he becomes Taoiseach. He has secured the support of a number of them, presumably. We know some of it, but with promises to address issues of their concerns. Peter O'Rourke, is this the strength of independence, or is it simply a sellout, really, and a case of the government buying votes and support?
Well, I think it is a case of buying support. I mean, we have a bridge up in Donegal, which an independent politician managed to procure for Donegal. So I think everybody will give support, provided they get what they want for their area, which isn't necessarily good for politics, but it's certainly what's going to happen. I don't think we're going to have an election before the new year, and in all likelihood, the next government will probably have even more independence. And if an independent can get something for his vote in his local area, I'm sure it'll encourage the populace to vote for them.
Do you think that is the case? I mean, obviously, you know, a lot of the electorate might be choosing to vote independent because they are tired of, you know, the same old, as they might see it in government. They don't really think that Sinn Féin offers the alternative that maybe they seek. But if your option are independents that row in behind government, is that really a vote for independence in the true sense of the word?
I don't think it's a vote for independence, but I mean, a weak government is not a good government. I mean, it would be better whoever is in power actually has the power to pass legislation rather than have to sort of beg, steal and borrow to get enough votes to get legislation through. And I'm not sure if it's a good thing having an increased number of independents, because it all just weakens the government and makes coalitions more difficult. I mean, if you look at countries, I think it's Belgium haven't had an actual government for a year or more, because there's too many different parties involved in it. And when you have numerous independents who are only supporting various aspects of government, it makes it more difficult.
Did they bother contacting you anymore, Thomas?
No, he hasn't contacted me. I mean, basically, the independents that he has contacted are the independents that have been supporting the government anyway since the foundation of this government, and that's who it is there. If I could just, Greg, take some issues with what Peter was saying about independence and stuff like that there as well, because
of course that's what we're
in reality for. That's not the situation. And, you know, and what you'll see now in the run-up to the general election, you'll see Fianna Fáil run around saying about what a benefit to Donegal it has been having Charlie McConnell out here. And he's certainly not an independent. And it's going to say that only because Charlie's here that we've got X, Y, and Z. You know, so this is what happens in politics. And that's the reality of the situation.
But how do you deliver anything, though, for your constituents as an independent, really, because you're a sole voice? You won't vote with a government on issues for the benefit of your region. I think you're on the record saying that. So what do you actually bring to the party, pardon the pun?
No, I wasn't on the record saying I won't vote for the government for issues on the benefit of the region.
I thought that your approach was that you decide that you're a national TD. You know, obviously you're a local TD, but I seem to recall us having the conversation and you saying that even if it meant you losing your seat, that you would do what's best for the country, not necessarily what's best for Killybegs.
Well, what's best for the country is best for Killybegs as well, and it's best for Donegal, and that's the reality, and that's what people need to get beyond. And, you know, and people make the decisions on voting at election time based on personalities rather than based on political parties. And I, for one, certainly don't feel that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have been good for the country. And having Fianna Fáil majority governments and stuff like that there, as what Peter says is desirable, is actually what led to the mica crisis that we've had and we've lived through in this county for many years. And it's what's led to the defective building materials crisis right across the country, which is going to come to light in the next couple of years. And that has been by having majority governments, and that's been governments that have been led by developers and by the building industry rather than being led by the interests of the people. And that's the difference that it makes, Greg. And whether it's an independent or whether it's a political party, if they're doing it for the wrong reasons, you will have bad government.
All right, so just on that, you were up at the meeting in Burt, and you fully endorsed the people's document on the issue of defective concrete. I mean, this is hypothetical, but you never know. But if Simon Harris came to you and said, look, I need your support, Thomas, as Taoiseach over the next year, you know, and I will strive, I'll do my very best to meet the concerns contained within the people's document, Would you support the government in that context?
No, that's something that I'd have to think very seriously about and think and wonder whether the government would be serious about that.
But if they were, would you say, right, well, us?
Yeah, I would seriously consider it. Yeah, and I would have to ask him, well, why hasn't it been done up to now? Mm-hmm. And that's something that you would have to see, and you'd have to see that the commitment would be there, and that could be something that would play out and see how that develops. And that actually would benefit the people of Donegal, but it would actually benefit the whole country nationally as well, because there's a huge amount of defective products, building products, going to come to light and coming to light right across the country. So that, and the great thing about the people's document is that it says that they have to learn from the crisis and they have to make sure that it doesn't happen again. And that's very important. And so if Simon Harris came to me and said, yeah, look, in the next year, we're going to sort this out, well, then that's something that I would have to think very seriously about.
Well, that's interesting. OK, I didn't anticipate that answer. Emma Gover, well, I just didn't, but I'll just be honest. Emma, I mean, is it a case of, you know, fair play if Mark McSharry gets, you know, further investment into Sligo University Hospital, or another TD gets, you know, a better commitment into Limerick as an independent? Is that really what they're doing? They're representing their people, and fair play to them?
Well, do you know what? I mean, Simon Harris has come out and said that this is, it's not transactional, it's an alignment with policy. But I mean, we're not stupid. Everybody knows it's transactional.
In 5 or 6 months, there'll be a freedom of information request and we'll find out precisely what was promised. I mean, what's silly?
Well, no, it is transactional, because you look at the likes of Tipperary TD Michael Lowry, who has been the most vocal about what he's been promised. I mean, he's saying that he brought up, when in his talks, he brought up University of Limerick Hospital and the overcrowding and the negative effect it's having on Nina Hospital, where elective surgeries are having to be cancelled because patients that Limerick can't cope with are being sent there. And Minister Harris has told him that they are going to make this a priority, they're going to engage in it on short-term measures to alleviate the problems. He also talked about issues for farmers' supports and additional measures that needed to be introduced. And although Patrick Donoghue maybe has come out and said, no, we're not giving any additional supports, I mean, he's telling Michael Lowry that they are looking at it. And then he's also talking about support for small businesses and a direct line of communication with Simon Harris for future issues that he himself can go to him directly and talk to about. So, and Simon Harris has said that he is open to that. So basically, you know, a vote from Michael Lowry is in return for the issues at which Minister Harris, the incoming Taoiseach, has said he will deal with. So, you know, what you've got to ask yourself is, what are the people of Donegal going to be losing out on? You know, at the end of the day, we have our own crisis here as well. And as we spoke about that this week, I mean, our own hospital has been overcrowded 11 out of the 12 months last year. We were the second most overcrowded in January of this year. We had 5,300 people at Midlothian Hospital without a bed last year, and 1,200 had left without treatment. We have massive shortages in respite care. And there are actually children come from Cork to Donegal for respite, and children from Donegal being told they can't access respite and they're being sent to Dublin. So, I mean, would that not be good for the country as well if we could get a better investment in our disability services and healthcare services? So, yeah, it is transactional. And my concern, and I'm not telling anybody which way to vote, but my concern is it's going to be a reward for the loyal and those who shore them up, and those who don't are going to maybe even lose resources, and then it's the people of the county that are going to suffer. And that's what concerns me as a person who advocates for people with disabilities and complex medical needs. It worries me that it's you scratch my back, I scratch, and I know it's been that way for a long time. I'm not naive, but I do worry that we are going to lose resources.
The thing that concerns me, Emma, is that when needed, we can deal with things. You know, that's the problem.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't have these resources for farmers a week ago. No, you know, you've been allocated your funding, and now Pascal Donoghue may have come out and said that, oh, we're not giving any extra money. But Simon Harris has told Michael, well, according to Michael Lowry, Simon Harris has said no, he is going to look at extra supports for farmers. But you know, if that support is available, why isn't it being given out? Do you know what I mean? This should not be held like a carrot to the people who are representing their mm-hmm. constituents, that you know holding over people and saying, you know what, if I get my way, then you'll get this. That should not be the way it is. If the resources are available, they should be made available. I mean, University Hospital Limerick should have been dealt with long before now. They are in crisis mode down there. And the fact now that all of a sudden they're coming in with these short-term measures and they've opened up 86 beds yesterday. And I mean, this is, why weren't they doing that months ago when people were crammed in trolleys? And you know, people literally, I mean, the report came out last week that said a man lay dead for an hour before he was discovered, and now all of a sudden they're finding these resources. I mean, it's ridiculous. It is absolutely ridiculous, and it's a disservice to the people that come to it. It really is. It cheapens politics. I'm sorry, but it does.
Peter O'Rourke mentioned, Thomas, that he believes that there'll be an election next year. What's your view on it? I suppose we don't know what the impact of people leaving, being elevated or moving to sort of... talking nonsense. We don't know the impact in terms of numbers that the EU elections will have and what have you. You know what I mean? So do you believe that? I mean, obviously Simon Harris is gonna want a year at it, the 10 months he has at it. But what do you think? How long do you think this government will go on for?
Well, I think they plan to go on to March next year, and it depends if those TDs are elected to the European Parliament. Those by-elections by law now have to take place within 6 months, so that would put you into probably, I think it's from the date of the European Parliament's sets that you become an MEP, and you would have deemed to have resigned from the Dáil. So that, I think that would be sometime in July. So 6 months from that would bring you up to the end of January or something like that there. So look, there's going to be an election probably in October, November. It definitely has to be by March next year, and that's when it's going to be. It's possible that there could be an election next week if Simon Harris didn't get elected as Taoiseach, but I doubt that very much as well. And, you know, and just if I could just go back and just in relation to the conversation about the value of independence, and I think you'd have to ask what the value is of having a government minister in the constituency if Letterkenny General Hospital is under so much pressure in that there. And we've had government ministers sitting at cabinet for the last 15, 20 years, and nothing has developed in relation to that. You know, so maybe there is no value in having any TDs at all in the
current system. Now we're getting down to the nitty-gritty.
That's something that people will have to talk about, but it's certainly not, you know, why should it be the value of an independent that Letterkenny can be sorted out when you have a government
but
minister?
But sometimes...
You should have the cabinet and makes the decisions in relation to the spending of money and that Letterkenny General Hospital is declining.
But sometimes in asking what the value of independence, it might sound like it's phrased as a negative question, as if to say they're worthless, but at the end of the day, you know, Thomas, in terms of going out to your voters... It is they that might question, you know, what is an independence, and conversations like this actually maybe, reinforce what your belief system is versus what, someone down the country might be. So I don't think it's necessarily negative. A caller says, did Peter say government needs to be strong to pass legislation? Well, maybe that's a good thing about having so many independents, is that they will listen to the people who elected them and not pass legislation that is not what the people want or to the people's disadvantage. Example, the hate speech bill. Now, we are in the company this morning of Deputy Thomas Pringle, Dr. Peter O'Rourke and Emma Gova. Could Thomas support Simon in a deal for Donegal? Should he not try, asks a listener, so that you reach out and say to him, Thomas, I might back you, but I need such and such.
Well, there's no point in me doing that there, because Simon Harris isn't looking for my backing and isn't looking for the support of the people of Donegal for his candidature for Taoiseach. And he will have the support of Charlie McConnell and Joe McHugh when it comes down to it. And that's the case. If it was the case that he was looking for support and needed support, then you'd be in a position that maybe you could push for something. But that's not the situation at the moment.
A report which suggests an annual bill of €20 billion for 20 years to fund a united Ireland has been described by some as a worst-case scenario. I think that's Sinn Féin's position. The report by the Institute of International and European Affairs said the significant expense would require an increase in taxation of around 25% and or a significant reduction in expenditure. I think the criticism of the report that it doesn't fully account for a potential uplift as well. But this does, I think, give us an insight into what will likely be the actual public debate when it really gets into full swing. And with that in mind, Peter, do you think the people of Ireland, I don't know if you want to take it as a whole, north and south, do you think the people of Ireland would vote in favour of unification when the balance sheets are laid bare?
I think from a financial point of view, unless people were certain that it would not significantly damage the economy and damage their finances personally, I think there would be a certain amount of reluctance. I mean, German reunification cost a hell of a lot, and I think the German economy still hasn't completely recovered from it. And that's been, what, 25 years or so. So the economic side of things, I mean, when you think of the children's hospital as an example, which has doubled in, or if not tripled in cost from when it actually started, never mind when it was considered, the estimates they're giving for what it would cost the economy are probably a drop in the ocean from the reality that would actually come to pass. So from that side of things, I think there might be a significant amount of reluctance.
And I think that there'd be sort of probably difference of opinion geographically. I think, I wonder, further south you go, would the Irish public be more sensitive to the potential impact, negative impact it might have on them? You know, whereas in Donegal, I suppose we might see things differently.
I think that's probably true. But ultimately, we now have a situation where everybody has expectations of being financially secure and getting access to everything they want, having their new iPhone every year or two, having Sky and every other streaming service, being able to go on holidays whenever they like, and having a good quality of life, working from home.
Where are these people?
30 hours a week.
Who are these people? I don't know who they are, but
this is the expectation. Okay. And if somebody was going,
I've just had to sell my car to clear off the credit union loan. I don't know who the hell you're talking about.
Well, I said expectation rather than reality. Okay. And if you take the expectation away, good luck.
Okay, Emma, what do you think? You know, I mean, let's just, I mean, obviously there's going to be a, there's going to be a conversation, you know, about a united Ireland for political reasons and cultural reasons and what have you. But of course, as I've just been saying to Peter, you know, the balance books are going to be out on the table as well here. What impact might it have in health service? Where would cancer services be delivered in the Northwest? Where would you go for treatment? You know, and again, the financial impacts, even if 20 billion is a worst case scenario, I don't think anyone's disputing that it would cost the state considerably. Emma, do you think that the people, the great people of this country, this island, would vote in favour for unification?
Well, I actually watched the debate last night between Lisa Chambers, Padraig McLaughlin and Professor Fitzgerald, and they did a poll, albeit a short one, on The Tonight Show, and 63% said no, that they would not want to see their taxes raised for a united Ireland. 35% said yes, and 2% said they weren't sure. But, I mean, that's 63% said no. You know, people... I am a proud Irish person. I would love to see united Ireland in my time. But realistically speaking, given the cost of living crisis we've just come through, when we had the economic crash, people, they're still very fresh in people's minds. And people may vote with their wallets. I mean, there are other studies out there, like from the British University of Columbia, that actually says that there'd be a $34 billion benefit over 8 years. And then the Professor Seamus McGuinness has said that this is vastly pessimistic view, that it's actually more like $3 billion. But at the end of the day, you're going to have to bring social welfare, you're going to have to bring in the public sector pay in line with the Republic, because you can't have a two-tiered system. I would hate to see Ireland go through our own version of Brexit by not planning properly. I think that it needs real economic analysis, and we need to look in depth at the education system and the health system, and it needs properly planned and prepared for. But if people think that it's going to cost them 20 billion a year for 20 years, work out at 55 million a day, when you break it down like that, as much as they want to see it, and I want to see it, they probably are going to vote with their wallets. That is the reality.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Thomas?
Well, I didn't see the programme there, and I haven't had the chance to read the report as yet in relation to it. But there's no doubt that the reunification would have a cost involved in it, and there's no doubt about that. But it would also require the British government to support the reunified Ireland financially for a number of years to actually the transition period that would take place in relation to that. So the ongoing cost wouldn't be significantly as much probably as what they're saying. But also as well as that, we have to think about the positive that would come out of this too. You know, the reality is that in the 26 county state as we have now at the moment, we're running short of workers, we're running short of people actually to sustain the economy as it is ongoing. And in a unified country, we're adding an extra 1.5 to 2 million people, and everybody will be working together towards the benefit of the whole country. And that would make a difference, and economically would make a difference to actually how we can develop further on. And remember as well too that at the moment we run a surplus in this country, something like in the next 3 years there'll be something like as a 40 or 50 billion that will be put aside by the state. You know, so the state is in a very strong position, and also as well what we need to look at too is like we've had we continue to have the state looking after the wealthy and looking after the rich and to the detriment of everybody else is what you said yourself there, Greg, and you know, so what we're talking about is a new state, and we're talking about as a new country. It's not going to be Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael rubber stamping and taking over 32 counties instead of the 26 counties and making aims of that. And you know, so it's going to be a completely new dynamic, and I think that's going to be very positive, and it's going to be something that's going to be very attractive. And I think that we have to have a full debate and plan for this, as Emma was saying, and that as part of that will be the economic arguments. But I would certainly be arguing very strongly that the economic arguments outweigh anything else, and we should be getting together and coming together as a 32 county state that would actually benefit everybody living here.
It'd be interesting to see, Peter, who, if any, would step out of the shadows or out of the ranks to campaign against a reunification in the Republic, and what angle they might come at.
I don't think anybody is against reunification. It's an ideal. It's just that how it is achieved and the time frame, and as we mentioned, all the, be it the healthcare systems, the social welfare systems, the educational systems, it's going to take time. I mean, as I mentioned Germany as an example, Germany still, although there has been reunification, the East and the West are still very different places. The economies of the two sides of Germany are different.
Voting patterns,
the attitudes of the people and everything
is still different. Okay. And I suppose
the economy of Germany is still the biggest economy in Europe.
Yeah. But also too, really, like, I presume if there were a vote, there would be a time frame and a transition, you know, be it 10, 5 or 10 years, I don't know how long it might be. And that's really when all this is worked through, isn't it? Sort of, so to some extent, I can see the benefit of this report, but it kind of feels a bit moot in that we don't really even know what the British role might be. And there's no guarantee that they'll want to dig deep for this either. So I suppose, or what the EU's role, for instance, might be. So there's a lot of unanswered, but still I think we're kind of easing in the direction of where the debate most likely will be. Greg, what's the point in a united Ireland when the Irish are going to be a minority in the future? I don't think the Irish are going to be a minority in the future. There might be different people here, but I can't see how they could be a minority unless 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 million people were to move here. Comparing the unification of Germany and Ireland is not great examples, in my opinion. Example, monkeys and drafts. We can't compare it like for like, but I mean, it would... It's obvious that there has to be some learnings from the reunification of Germany that we can look at here, I think. In fairness now, Greg, Harris is simply using the typical election book here, bringing independents on board, promising this, that and the other. He'll be no different than Varadkar. Wait until the real election and we will see. And on it goes. Okay, we're going to take a break and we're going to be back with more from Deputy Thomas Pringle, Dr. Peter O'Rourke and Emma Gover after these. Stay where you are. GPs host a conference next week here in County Donegal in Letterkenny opposing the Dying with Dignity Bill. Should choosing when you die be a right, or will it change how we care for people and maybe even the value we put on life? And I suppose given your healthcare background, Dr. Peter O'Rourke, I'll start with you. We're talking about assisted dying, assisted suicide, as I think those most likely to oppose it tend to call it. What's your view?
I think it's overdue. There is a sort of a thought that life should be preserved at any cost. I think sometimes life can be hell on earth. And for certain medical conditions, when people are dying in pain or have no hope, I think it has to be considered. The difficulty is, how do you legislate for it and how do you monitor it? And that's the difficulty. And the excuse against it is always you'll have relatives killing off their old age relatives that are a burden, or rather than sort of it being used in a humane and considered way. But I think it will eventually come in, as it has come in a lot of countries throughout the world.
Why? Why should it come in?
Well, from a personal point of view, if I had a terminal condition and I was in extreme pain, if I could put myself out of my misery and put my family out of my misery and their misery as well, I'd be quite happy to do it. And just because someone else has a moral objection to it, be it religious or other means, it doesn't mean that they should force you to into a situation where you have to suffer just to salve their conscience.
But say you were diagnosed with something, let's say MS, for an example, and it was determined that and MS comes in all different forms, of course, but that it was determined that this would eventually take your life. It would reduce your mobility, your quality of life, and eventually would take your life. Like, even at what stage? Is it immediately post-diagnosis? Is it once you no longer can move around yourself? At what point would we say, okay, it's all right at this, it's okay now to unburden your loved ones and take your own life?
Well, that's the whole argument. You have two aspects. You have, say, you can't do it, or you can do it, but when? And the conversation we should be having is you can do it and when, rather than that you just can't do it under any circumstances. And that is the argument that needs to be had, I think. But I mean, I agree with you, it is difficult, but there are some people whose lives are so miserable and are in so much pain that they do not want to be alive. And I think that we have to respect that.
But please correct me if I'm wrong. I seem to talk to you many, many years ago, and I'll retract it instantly if I'm incorrect. But I seem to recall you questioning sending older people with cancer long distance for treatment, with you know going through the ordeal of that, you know, with perhaps maybe extending the life short term. Am I correct in, was that a view that you've shared?
More or less. I mean, I think there is a point where life should not be maintained because it can be. And just because it can be, there are times when people have lived their lives and they should be able to die peacefully and without going through further suffering. So, yes, but I don't think it's a different argument to the one I'm already making.
Yeah, of course, I get that. But I'm just wondering, does in some way are they kind of related? But anyway, I'll move on to Emma now. Emma, what's your view on that? I mean, do you see any circumstances where we should have assisted dying legislated for in this country?
Oh, that's a loaded gun, isn't it, that question? You know, when it first came out and we realised there has been an Oireachtas committee put together to discuss this, and I commend them on it because it's a very difficult conversation, it's a very sensitive subject. I personally myself was aghast. I'm a mother of children with complex medical needs. My oldest daughter has a progressive disease, and I think more of I was seeing it as Dr. Orca said, you know, I didn't want her to feel compelled later on in life to have to feel like I need to do this to make life easier for everybody else. And I was so hard line in that decision, and I was very against it until I actually had a conversation with her about it. And her point of view would be, as a person with a progressive disease, is that she herself would not want it. She wouldn't ask for it, but she wants to live as long as she possibly can. We hope that she lives till she's 60 or 70, you know, but she had a long conversation with me and she said, because I want that does not mean that I have the right to tell somebody else with this condition who is living in extreme pain that they know is going to get worse. There are some people in their 20s and 30s with it who are already having TPN feeding and are very immobile, and they have stomas and things like that, and their quality of life is greatly reduced. And you know, the thing is, I don't have the right to tell them just because I want to, that they should too. I think it's a very sensitive.
So your daughter's saying, your daughter's saying, just to be clear, and I know we're all choosing our language very carefully, daughter's saying that she can't see a scenario where she would opt for assisted dying, but she at the same time wouldn't be of the view then that, because that's how she feels, all the people in similar situations might feel different.
Yeah, that's exactly what she's saying. The only part that concerns me about it now, for me personally, from a moral point of view, and when you say that, it sounds like you're judging somebody, and I'm not. I'm just saying from my own personal point of view, I struggle with the concept of it greatly. But my concern is how we regulate it. You know, I know they're saying that it's going to be between 6 to 12 months to live, and two independent doctors will have to sign off on it. But my concern is later on down the line, if amendments are made.
Well, that's what we've seen in other countries. That
where it came in, it was very regulated, and now, I mean, there was a story of a girl. I remember reading the article, in an actual newspaper online, who had suffered with depression chronically for 12 years, and two doctors signed off in a European country for her assisted dying. And whilst I don't deny that woman was in extreme emotional pain, my concern is the regulation around it.
Yeah,
you know,
but
the amendments.
But I suppose a big conversation we often have is that, you know, we need to see, you know, poor mental health the same way we see physical health. So I suppose that's the argument.
And I wouldn't like to think that if this does come in, this is the other part that concerns me, is that if this comes in, it's kind of then an opt-out to invest in services to help people who don't want to avail of this. You know, I wouldn't like to see that. Yeah. I wouldn't like to see resources stripped back because there is this other option.
I mean, there are the GPs feel that this will change necessarily. This will change, you know, care of the elderly, end-of-life care, palliative care, hospice care, that, you know, once this is introduced, that changes an awful lot of stuff. But Deputy Pringle, I think there was a couple of votes in the Dáil on this. Was it Gino Kelly's bill? Is that his second name? Did you vote on this yet? Was it yes, no? What's your...
Gino brought forward a bill to allow for assisted dying, and it was the private member's bill. I think from memory, it was passed, but delayed. The implementation date was delayed to allow for the committee report to happen. And basically, what the situation is now is that the committee has reported and made recommendations. Now, then, what happens is the government has to draft legislation, and then that legislation then will come before the Dáil and be debated and passed then as well. So I don't know whether it'll come before the end of this government. I'm not sure about that. And also, you know, and it is a very difficult situation, and it's a situation that Emma's really outlined as very significantly for somebody that could potentially be directly affected by it. And you know, and I would the one thing I would say is that as far as I understand it, the illnesses that would be allowed, this would be allowed for, and the prognosis would be very tightly controlled. And you know, and we have to make sure that is the case. And it's a very personal decision as well for the people that are involved in it, obviously. And we've had high profile cases of people who wanted to.
So are you minded to vote in favour of it if the checks and balances that you talk of were there? You know what I mean? I know it's a bit hypothetical here, but basically, do you find yourself leaning towards the fact that you probably could back something if it was set up the right way?
Yeah, I think so. I think that it is something that, if set up properly and with the proper checks and balances in there, it could be something that would help a certain amount of people. But we have to make sure that it helps the people that want to help, but the people that don't want that are also getting help there as well. You know, and that's vitally important.
Yeah, but the problem is that when something is legislated for, that very quickly that legislation can change. We literally don't have the time, but maybe sort of the abortion system we have in this country at the moment is very different to what was put to the people to vote on, some would feel as well. And I think maybe that might carry over into this. But unfortunately, we don't have time to tease that out unless someone thinks I've said something wrong there. It needs clarification. Now we're happy enough.
Well, the only thing is that legislation should be able to respond and should be able to change. And the only alternative is, as we say, right, no, you can't do it, and leave things as they are. And that leaves people in a traumatic situation that they will have to deal with in the future without any support from society. And I think that's wrong.
Right. Deputy Thomas Pringle, thank you very much for your time. It's about 60-40 in favour of you having no beard. I'm not sure if you care. But that's where we're at.
It fell off.
Like the hair at the top of my head.
To manage.
All right, take care, Thomas. Thanks very much indeed, Deputy Thomas Pringle. Emma, lovely having you on the show. Thank you so much for all of your time.
Thanks.
Have a lovely day. And last but certainly not least, a good friend of the show, Dr. Peter O'Rourke. Thank you for your time, Peter. Take care of yourself. Okay, we'll be back with more on the 9 till noon show after we take a break for the news and obituary notices. Seamus Gunn is going to be joining us after 10.